The Red Door Podcast is focused on highlighting key players, industry disruptors, and the issues faced in the world of education. The goal of our podcast is to inform you, the audience, with information that will empower, expand, and increase your abilities. This platform will help you become a better parent, children's advocate, teacher, therapist, and administrator. Get ready. Session starts in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Should I just call you Dr. Moore?
Yeah, Jeanette is fine. Dr. Moore is fine.
Okay, cool. I like the Dr. Moore.
Right? It was hard work. I know sometimes when people get a doctorate, they're like, they better call me doctor because it was X amount of years. But I'm still stepping into that identity 5 years later. I'm the only one in my family. It's just my career is an anomaly to how I grew up, where I grew up, and my family. So I'm also stepping into it because it's an identity piece as a teacher to become a leader. So whatever you prefer, I'll answer to it all.
Okay, so Dr. Moore, you worked so hard to get that designation, so I'm going to use it today on our special conversation with Red Door. I wanted to kick it off by, I know you've had a very diverse background. How do you actually get started, you know, when your mission to working with families and children and the people that you're actually servicing today?
School was always a haven for me. So it gave me stability, predictability, meals. It was very important to go to school, even though, you know, it's not a kid's favorite place to be, but it was very important for me to go to my haven and excel. I had great relationships with my teachers very early on. So I was inspired to be a teacher. But I also had that innate, some of us just have that innate feel that we want to be a teacher or something when we're little, maybe not a teacher, but an artist or a creator or a writer,
right? Yeah,
something interrelated. So when we were in the neighborhood, when we would play games outside till, you know, when we could be outside late all night, and we would play school, or when we play house, I was mom, we play school, I'd be teacher. So those are roles even as a child I enjoyed. So it was sort of inevitable. I realized I enjoyed art and I like to create, but being a teacher was actually more lucrative than being an artist. I was interested in being a graphic artist, and I catapulted into my tutoring company really at 17. I graduated from Norwalk High School and I started a company immediately. I started a tutoring company.
Wow, at 17, that's amazing.
Yeah, I knew tutoring one-to-one and small group could be very lucrative, so I could pay for college. And I was inspired to help other students. I was in a peer leadership program in high school where, you know, there was some tutoring going on and some small group and stuff. So I just kind of carried that on. And I still, that's where I am right now, is at the tutoring office.
Wow. That's amazing. So what, I mean, you said a couple of things. Most 17-year-olds don't go off and start businesses. What, where'd that come from? Your family, are your mom, dad in business?
No, I'm from a long family of, immigrants to the Bronx and to Brooklyn, who ended up in Connecticut. My parents met at Caldor's, which was like Walmart. Caldor's. You know, it's not.
Yeah, it would be Caldor's.
Yeah, remember Caldor's, Bradley's. We, my dad was, stocking shelves. My mom was a cashier. It's not that, you know, I come from a long line of factory workers, people who are in the army, you know. So being a business person, being an entrepreneur in the field of education just sort of happened. I do naturally like to talk business, make deals, and I follow stocks. And it's an aspect of me that I like. I like the business aspect of education as well. The budgeting and purchasing materials. And also I've learned that through writing, you know, learning about royalties and learning about, how to defend myself in contract deals. And sometimes if we're a teacher leader, we get pulled into different directions that are business oriented. So that aspect is really a part of me too.
That's very powerful because I speak to a lot of educators and leaders, and they are so, it's not a bad thing, but they're very academic in nature, right? They never look in look into the business side of it. I myself understand that space well. So it's interesting it's very inspirational to hear you say that you're into the education as much as you're into the business, because I find that a lot of people that I speak to on these they're so just into the academic side, and recognize in order to be really, really powerful and to really spread the message, you got to go out and do the business side also.
Yeah, I mean it's America. America's a business,
Yeah, it is America.
and it's always has started out as a business. It was a joint stock company. Virginia was a joint stock company. Chesapeake Bay. So, it's this is the foundation. We're part of a system, and it's easy as teachers where we are social emotional creatures. We feel what our students need. We're very empathic. We're very sympathetic. And it's easy to get taken advantage of in this field,
Yeah.
or burnt out. That's a real phenomenon, right? Like you could get your whole doctorate on teacher burnout. Many of us in our careers are, we have to look at our even our public school contracts. What step am I on? If I get X amount of credits, how can I move up in the ladder? There's a business piece to it, whether we like it or not. So it's important to be savvy about it. Because that aspect, even being part of our union, or if we decide to set up our own companies, like Red Door, and you're expanding, and there is a business piece to it, even just
There is.
renting space, finding grants, everything. There's a whole sector of federal government grants that are just for us. But
Absolutely.
we do a lot of work that way too.
1,000%. Tell us about your background. I mean, we jump right into the meat and potatoes, but tell us more about your credentials, your schooling. I know you've done a lot of work, so I want to make sure that the people know who they're listening to,
Sure.
because you are definitely credible.
Thank you. I'm a serial nerd. Like I was in school for 33 consecutive years. I just
Wow.
finished, even while I was always establishing my businesses and teaching. I always liked to, since I went right away into private tutoring and having my own tutoring company, I needed my own professional development. I wasn't part of a public school system. I was went to UConn for psychology. I was at Yale. I went to I much preferred college in New Rochelle. So I dipped my toe into Ivy League, and I preferred to go to college in New Rochelle, which is now closed. Now you go to Mercy or Iona. And then I did prof and then I decided I'm going to go for my doctorate when my daughter was two at Western Connecticut State, where I was also an adjunct. And it was affordable because as you teach, you can take one class
Yeah.
for it's a very small fee. And then when I finished that, I went to get a certificate at Harvard for post-secondary success. So once our kids are done or shopping for colleges, 11th and 12th grade, how do we ensure that they're successful? So it was a very impactful program that I was really ready for once I had done all those other steps.
Wow.
And in between the gaps, I always like to do courses, gathering credits and making sure that I am up to par with the most innovative stuff. Because as we get older in the field, there's a lot of trends that I see my younger students. So I have pre-service teachers at WestCon. I teach intro to special ed. I see they're getting cutting edge stuff that we still have to keep our toe in. And it keeps you alive when you're always dipping yourself into professional development.
Absolutely.
Obviously, being a part of a school district, you get professional development, which has been helpful because I just joined a school district 3.5 years ago. Because sometimes when you own your own business, you're kind of on your own island.
Yeah,
You're
definitely.
going to the yearly whatever it may be, ASCD or ILA or IDA conferences, and
Yeah.
it can be isolating. So I've been all over private school, public school. In a
Where
little
do you
office in a big
big
school.
district, where do you see the educational system going? I mean, you are on the cutting edge. Where do you see education going? I mean, there's a whole new wave of virtual education and things like that. Where do you see it actually happening? I know you just touched on your younger teachers seeing some new and cool, exciting stuff in the world of special education. Where do you see education going?
I think we have to revamp it very much so. We're still on a factory system. I teach a reading class at Norwalk High School every morning, and it's these 88-minute, 42-minute, you know, sort of cycles of multiple classes. Do these all pertain to what our children are going to be doing in their professions? Do we look back and see if we're using a quadratic formula right now? You know, there's an overhaul that has to occur content-wise.
Interesting.
You know, but also social emotionally, because we have a different dynamic now. Unfortunately, we have to evolve because there's, the class I teach at Brian McMahon High School. So I'll teach at the high schools in the morning at public school. We have bulletproof shades. So it's very different now where we have and kids know it, you know, this is a different type of environment than the 80s and the 90s.
Right, because of the internet.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of it is related to our technology. It's a blessing and a curse.
Interesting. It's funny. I was just watching one of my partner's sons. He was just in the studio with us, and he's like 2 years old, and he's flipping through his father's iPhone.
So good, right?
I mean, flipping through his iPhone like it's part of his hand.
Yeah, they just know. I have a 2-year-old about to be 3. She just knows.
It's so weird though. Like he literally just flipping through it and looking for Coco Melon. I'm like, wow.
Yeah, yeah. They just know. They can unlock the phone.
Everything.
YouTube.
So now imagine when that kid is 27.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Fast the information is going to come to them, how fast, because all right, so a lot of the gap for Black and brown people have been, you know, access to the information.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So with the internet, I think that, I mean, if you know how to access it now, I mean, it's a lot easier to access information now.
Exactly.
If you really want it, right? Because everything's
all out there. All out there. It's all, you know, we don't have to go into look in the table of contents and go to the back of the index and
yeah,
it's page 426 to find this one paragraph. Well, we just Google it. Kids just Google it.
Even like going to the library, right? Where do you see libraries going?
Yeah, you know, it's funny when I wouldn't have offices, I would just meet kids at the library for that environment. You know, even behind you, behind me, just the books. Like we still have to relish in the books and use the books. But even prior to the pandemic, I was working online. I was using Google Meet prior to the pandemic because many of my students in my private in private educational services are at boarding schools. So we've been meeting online, or even they'll put me on FaceTime and then I'm in Google Docs live with
exactly.
them. And we're talking through FaceTime.
Yeah.
Been doing it for many years before the pandemic. So it's a good thing, and they have the information at their fingertips. They can pull articles. They have to know MLA APA citation to give accreditation to all the people that they're utilizing in their papers.
Yeah.
But libraries, I mean, they're becoming more and more digital, which is good and bad. You know, it's like that book, Fahrenheit 451, like all the books are gone and the people are easy to manipulate because they don't know their own history. So it's scary if we don't have the actual texts and the actual facts and everything is digital, but then it's great if we can just Google it and find it as long as the kids know, as long as they have critical reading skills where they can determine if something is real or fake. So there's many layers now to what we do. We're disseminating information, but we have to make sure it's the right information.
Absolutely.
You know, because there's just so much out there.
Talk to me. Let's talk a little bit about, OG, I need you to kind of expound that a little bit. I talked to my buddy James, and he was telling me that, you know, this is it. This is the only conversation to have. This is the only way, the only thing he wants to talk about. Can you give our audience a really, give us an understanding of what OG is, the technique, where it came from, all that stuff? Because I know people in the education community probably already know what it is, but some parents that may need to know what it is probably don't. You know?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, Orton Gillingham, two last names hyphened. And, you know, Orton Gillingham, I believe is from the 1930s, from Samuel Orton, who developed this technique of breaking down the code of language. So everything really starts with a sound and a letter. That sound symbol association. B will say B, he will say duh. Then we've got A. You know, an A is elusive. A can be a, A can be long A if we have an E on the end of the word, like cake. A can be a schwa, like in talk, T-A-L-K. It almost sounds like a aw, but it's just an A.
Yeah.
So Orton Gillingham gets to the heart of the code where we don't necessarily, you know, we've got our alphabet, which is X number of letters, but we actually have 44 phonemes. And if you think about other languages, you know, they have intonation for their characters and for their sounds and for their words. And sort of for us too, you know, with each letter sometimes comes multiple sounds. So Orton Gillingham is the science of looking at that code, because for some kids, it's just not natural. They're memorizing stuff because the code is sort of elusive, especially for our students who have dyslexia, which impacts 5 to 10% of our population, whether we are identifying them or not. It is genetic. It's highly paternal. So there's a lot more boys who have dyslexia.
Wow. So dyslexia is genetic.
Yes. Yeah. There are many findings now through, it's interesting because if you look at Yale's Center of Creativity through Sally Shaywitz and her husband, they identified students years and years ago, and they follow the families too. Sometimes they'll take MRIs and brain images of the children with dyslexia as well as relatives, or those kids now are having kids because they've been in the field forever. There's a lot of studies too that are coming out of the University of Michigan for techniques on working with students with dyslexia. There are a lot of stuff coming out of Great Britain as well. I do belong to the International Dyslexia Association. It's a wonderful, you know, even just to pay those dues every year and to get those articles from the Annals of Dyslexia and to attend their conferences. It's just eye-opening how complex our language is, how only 58 to 65% of our words are actually predictable to sound out. The rest we got to figure out, right? Because we are Latin, we are Greek, we are English, we are indigenous, native. A variety of different languages make up what we're calling English.
Yeah.
But reality, even like photograph, it's a wholly Greek word. You know, kindergarten, German. There's it just gets to the root of that because we are so blended, even within the tongue that we speak.
You know, it's very interesting. You know who, and I've said this before in a special conversation. Do you know who Sammy the Bull Gravano is?
Yes.
Okay, so Sammy the Bull, for those of you listening who don't know, was John Gotti's top hitman, who ended up testifying on John Gotti and blah, 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 right? So that's not the interesting part. The interesting part is I watched the interview with John Gotti, I'm sorry, with Sammy the Bull, and he said that part of the reason he ended up becoming a hitman was because in elementary school, in early years, he had dyslexia and he was misdiagnosed. So they thought the school, the teachers thought he was stupid, and he used to get upset and fight a lot, right? Yeah. And he realized that he wasn't really good at reading, but he could really fight. So he spent less time reading and more time fighting. And the fighting turned into hitting people with baseball bats. I think people with baseball bats turned into stabbing people and turns into shooting people. So, and he said, if somebody would have just paid some more attention to me earlier on in my life and my dyslexia, I probably wouldn't have had the life that I had. And that, when I heard that, it was so powerful to me because we have so many people in our community that are misdiagnosed. I know I have people in my own family that I know for a fact have dyslexia and, you know, kind of just scuttled along in school, you know, just trying to get by, more because of embarrassment, not because they were stupid, because they can do everything else. It's just that they didn't want to, they didn't know what was wrong with them, and neither did anyone else. Right.
Right. Yeah. It's tricky because also some of these kids are the opposite of the bull. You know, they are behaved. They're quiet. You know, they're the good kid. They hand in work. It's like, okay. You know, there are a lot of our C students. They just get through, stay under the radar. Powerful.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they're needed in society too. But, you know, the federal prisons, to speak to Sammy, is federal prisons are loaded with people who cannot read, or are neurologically wired like dyslexics, whether they're identified or dyslexic or not. I know a lot of new statistics recently came out for New York. I wish I could put my finger on the number, but it was a large amount of incarcerated people in the state of New York have dyslexia.
Well, and then there's the reverse, right? There's the people that have been diagnosed with dyslexia and they become super duper successful.
Absolutely.
Because right? They were treated early. They got the help they needed, and they were able to pinpoint on what the problems were, and yep. They focused on it, and they made their lives a lot better, and other people's lives extremely, extremely better.
Yeah, the Yale School of Medicine had lists and lists on their website of like famous people who, you know, was it Henry Winkler, like the Fonz, you know, mm-hmm. people who, Whoopi Goldberg, I believe. There are people on that list who we know, you know, their household names because they're actors and actresses, and they are utilizing whole word memory. You know, they memorize their script rather than dissecting words. People who have dyslexia are highly visual. Wow. They are excellent, you know, in history. They most likely, prior to the Gutenberg press and the printing of the Bible, when we weren't all literate, unless you were a scribe or someone in society who was required to write, civil service exam in China or whatever it may be culturally, you were a great lookout, you know, you were a sniper. There are techniques that a dyslexic can adapt to more easily. They're athletic, they're kinesthetic, they're tactile. It's not a bad thing.
Yeah, exactly. Once you have the information on how to deal with it, I find that problems are not really problems if you have the access to the solution. There's still an issue, but you can, if you know how to, so it's a difference between being fearful and not knowing how to solve an issue versus going through something, having a problem and knowing the answer, knowing that there's an end, knowing where to find the information to get you out of that situation.
Absolutely. Yeah. Dyslexics need a lot of motivation. Cause it's, I had one student, she's at UPenn right now. Mm-hmm. But she couldn't write her name. And she didn't know how to recognize her name in kindergarten. And we wrote, or I edited and helped her with her college essay when she was a senior in high school. And that was her topic. You know, I want to be a psychologist, and but I am dyslexic. And I knew it from when I was 5 years old, looking around at my peers who could write their name. I could not write my name. And wow. Her teacher would do it over and over. But, you know, she has learned to adapt. A lot of people with dyslexia, if they want to be in academia or whatever career they choose, they have to work harder. And it's a different type of tired when a dyslexic student will work with me. So it's best in small increments, which is why in Mr. Crouch's building, it worked very well, because the periods in the middle school are 39 minutes each, 38 minutes. So I was able to hit the kids before they get neurologically tired, because we're literally connecting synapses that they don't normally connect. They live in their occipital lobe, which is where your eyes go to the back of your head. They don't necessarily live in their temporal lobes around their ears. Or they do, but it's because they're picking up on background noises, you know, or sounds, but not necessarily letter sounds. So there's areas of the brain that we sort of light up when we're using the Orton-Gillingham technique.
So how do you, I want to, because it's such, I've heard such amazing stories about you using the OG technique. Tell us, so if there's a parent, give us your ideal case. Like, if there's a parent listening to this that has a dyslexic child, or, mm-hmm, you know, or a child that's frustrated thinking that they can't read, or they know that there's something wrong, how would they work with you? Mm-hmm. Like, bring us through that situation. What's the process? Do they need to get evaluated? Because a lot of times they don't even know that there's an issue, right?
Sometimes they just don't know, but also because the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So sometimes my mom turns to dad, like, did you have problems reading when you were young? Or, you know, so, and it's, sometimes it's a revelation and there's a conversation. But before we get to a PPT where those things occur, you know, mom and dad and guardians know best. I can't tell you how many people come in and they're like, yeah, my brother-in-law can't spell, and they're father-in-law can't spell. You know, sometimes you can see it in female lineage too, sometimes in that parent history, that initial history, that intake, when you're talking to a you know, when you're thinking about, as a parent, you're thinking about your background. I myself, two of my children have IEPs.
Wow.
And they, you know, I kind of think like my daughter's just like her dad. And dad had trouble with math and dad had trouble with handwriting. But they're phenomenal athletes. You know, he's got like, he's 50 years old, hopping on the back tire of a mountain bike. He's, you know, they ride dirt bikes and, you know, he has some, indigenous background as well. They're part of the Mi'kmaq tribe in Canada. So there's also, you know, and my other little one is, we're seeing how she is as she gets big, but mom and dad know first, know best, because you think about your family and your lineage, but also there's some real basics when it comes to dyslexia, and it doesn't exactly lock in right away. Really, the International Dyslexia Association, you know, it's not telling you to identify a child when they're 2, 3, 4 years old, because there's still a lot of connections happening, a lot of natural play and things that are occurring in the setting and social emotional stuff that has to come together. But really, once they're 7, 8, 9, and things just aren't clicking, that's the red flag. Like, why are we still working on letter formation when I really want you to start to try those initial chapter books? You know, there's that as that gap widens, there's something eye-opening that occurs. But yeah, really, we can't see that until 7, 8, 9. You know, those letter reversals, sometimes they correct themselves on their own. They're B's and D's, S's, 3's, 7's. You know, letters sometimes can be flip-flop numbers. You know, that sometimes, you know, that's an issue. But dyslexia has many levels, and it does, you know, start to rear its head 7, 8, 9. And a parent would want to just actively be observing and helping with some of the homework and things like that, things that are coming home, so that they can keep their finger on the pulse. In any Orton Gillingham lesson plan, even with my big kids, on the top of the paper, we're writing our ABCs. And that's really revealing when the kid is 7, 8, and 9, and you have them write their ABCs in uppercase and lowercase. Right there, if you see any issues, talk to the teacher.
Definitely, definitely. How would someone get in contact with you if they wanted to? And of course, we're going to post a link to your stuff at the bottom of the of this conversation. But there's going to be so many people, so many parents that are very interested in talking to you. How would they get in contact with you? Is there a website? Is there an Instagram? Is there a phone number? Is there something you want to give out?
Yes, there. So I'm part of the International Dyslexia Association and Center for Effective Reading Instruction. So you can find my information there. You can also email me at Western Connecticut State, MOOREJ@WCSU.edu. It goes right to my phone. I check it every 24 hours. MOOREJ@WCSU.edu. We're doing a lot of exciting things at Western Connecticut State. And probably your Mr. Crouch, your colleague, mentioned we got a book deal for writing textbooks for special education.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. So it's broadening, you know, I'm looking into creating a dyslexia certificate program. I'm working with the state of Connecticut. New York has got their finger on the pulse for screening. All five boroughs are screening for dyslexia using the Shaywitz screener the next year or two. So we're on the edge of making sure that our children are readers, and I'm happy to talk to any parents. Well, even if you have samples, you know, if you have your kids' samples of writing, we can dissect them together. A lot of times parents will show me what a student has done for their homework. You know, take a look at this. And sometimes that's our evidence for us to start creating a paper trail and meaningful conversations and emails and dialogues with the teachers that are in the children's lives, so that you can move it forward and see if the child needs more than just classroom instruction. Maybe they would need some tiered instruction, RTI, SRBI, or special education.
Every conversation that I've had with an educator or a leader as a part of the series has always had some sort of touching story. Do you have one of your experience? Well, really, yeah, real quick, I just want to make sure that everyone knows that. So you are a trainer of teachers also with OG, right? So you train teachers on this method,
this methodology? Technically, yeah, because I'm part of the Academy of Orton Gillingham, I am an associate level. You have to be a fellow to be training teachers in it. However, I am a consultant.
Okay, you are a consultant.
So I oftentimes will consult, you know, with, I've even consulted with some schools on how they can make more effective reading practices and connected them to live 30-hour trainings with fellows. But I'm also in CERI and I'm a verified practitioner. So as a practitioner, I absolutely can provide consultations, and those are really effective. But I do my most, ironically, my most memorable student who really changed my life passed away. He had a drug overdose a few years after I worked with him. But he was a student who was brilliant, and he just, that confidence piece, I didn't get to him. I didn't get to teach him to read till he was in 11th grade.
Wow.
And he went through a very affluent local public school system not far from here. And they let him go, let him go, let him go. He's a nice kid. He didn't rock the boat. Work got harder. You're placed in different classes. You know, you don't get opportunities sometimes for those AP classes and things if you don't have the reading level.
Yeah.
And it really wore away at his confidence, which I think was part of the root of his drug issue. So that was really eye-opening for me. If we don't start young when they're little and getting them used to print and exposed to print, we don't build that neurological framework. We don't do the science. And it really can impede on a child's confidence. Even when you mentioned the Sammy the Bull, it can really change a person's life if they just don't have access to the text. Of course, it can go the other way. But, you know, we all have our stories when we were little. But, you know, it's really for people to take the time to make sure there's those foundational pieces for reading in the classroom happening. We really can change a lot of lives. Our kids are going to have jobs. We don't even know what those jobs are going to be.
Yeah.
So we have to prepare them at the very least with math and reading.
This has been a powerful conversation. I'm sure that we are going to help a lot of people find a better way, especially children with dyslexia and parents dealing with children with dyslexia, or adults, right? Dealing with dyslexia who don't know.
Yep.
Families. I'm going to make sure that I send out all your information to everybody. Thank you for taking the time with us.
No problem. It's a pleasure. I love collaborating. If there's anything too that goes forward, if any of the parents are interested in having something together, we can do something together as well through your organization. I'm always happy to contribute.
Definitely. Dr. Moore.
Yeah.
Pleasure again. And thank you for joining our special conversations.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Red Door Podcast. For more information on Red Door Learning Centers, please visit our website at reddoorlearningcenters.com. If you'd like to be featured on our next episode, send an email to info@reddoorlearningcenters.com. You can find us on all social media platforms at Red Door Learning Centers. Until next time.